release from
in the morning.
On an early fall day, a half century ago this weekend. Well, it was a pleasant day in Chicago. Clear skies, summer temperatures lingering in the 70s. The number one song on the Billboard charts was My Heart Has a Mind of Its Own by Connie Francis. And here in the city, broadcast history was about to be made twice. The most obvious event at the time was taking place at the studios of WBBM Television.
I think Mr. Nixon is
the very first ever debate between two presidential candidates.
The question before us,
Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, prepared to change the dynamics of American politics forever.
Want to leave the United States.
But another historic moment was taking place in the radio studios of WGN as a 27-year-old farm boy from Wisconsin was about to utter his first words on 50,000-watt clear channel AM 720.
You want to broadcast? You got a direct wire to WGN Chicago. Radio.
I'm John Williams, and this is a look back and celebration of the 50-year career that followed and continues of my friend and colleague Orion Samuelson. Orion and I recently sat down on a stage at Gibson Steakhouse Rosemont in front of 100 or so colleagues, family members, business associates, and fans. All of us fans.
I am ready. That's my Lyle Dean voice.
So we'll do about 50 years and 30 minutes, okay?
Okay.
You were born March 31st, 1934, on a farm in a manger because there was no room at the inn.
Careful.
Really, but it is weird, isn't it? Because, I mean, we're speaking about your age so much, and yet you aren't retired. The program says the legend continues. You're still broadcasting. You're still playing the game. It is remarkable that way alone.
And Monday, September 27th, I'll start my second 50s. You know, I've done 50. I'm going to do another 50.
So let's start backwards and work forwards to the current.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about life on the farm.
Life on the farm, and my kids, when they were growing up, referred to this as my Abe Lincoln story, because I grew up on a farm without electricity and without indoor plumbing, and that didn't change until I was 14. Question I'm asked today is, what is the biggest change in technology that you have seen in the years you've been doing this? Because I've been broadcasting now for 58 years. And the response to that question, John, depends on your age. The biggest change in technology I've seen happened April 11th, 1948, when the REA, Rural Electric Administration, hooked up the Samuelson Farm to electricity. And electricity is the biggest change in technology I've seen. Totally changed life on the farm and totally changed life in rural America. And that day, my mother threw away the flat irons that sat on the wood cook stove. And I stood at the foot of the stairs, and instead of carrying a kerosene lamp up the stairs, I flicked a switch and the light was on in my bedroom. We no longer had to depend on the windmill for water because we had an electric motor running the pump. And we had an electric milking machine. I didn't have to milk cows by hand anymore. But keep in mind that because I spent 14, well, not quite 14 years, but probably 10 of those 14 years milking cows by hand, I am the five-time Illinois State Fair cow milking champion.
Let's hear it for Orion.
Yeah, yeah. Don't mess with these hands. Don't mess with these hands. But went to a one-room eighth-grade country school, and when I graduated from eighth grade, I was excited but scared because I was now going to town school where the kids kind of picked on country kids. And that summer after eighth grade, before going to high school, I developed a bone disease that made me an invalid for 2 years. I couldn't walk for 2 years. And I thought, why has God done this to me? I was a tall kid. I was going to play basketball. Now I can't walk for 2 years. I'm going to fall behind my school with my friends. And outside of my parents, the person who changed my life more than anybody else was the vocational agriculture teacher at Ontario High School, because in the summer he'd come out and visit the farms of his freshman students incoming, encourage them to take agriculture, join the future farmers of America. And Mr. Gehring came out to the farm, found me flat on my back with a body cast from my chest to my feet, mad at the world. We talked. he had an artificial arm. He'd lost an arm as a youngster when he was six. And we talked, and he finally said, "Do you think you can study by yourself?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Do you have to be in a classroom?" And I said, "No, I like school." And so he said, "Well, if you think you can do that, I'll come out two nights a week to the farm." We were about 5 miles from town. "And bring you your assignments from the other teachers. I'll take your finished work back, and that way you won't fall behind." So in those days, I was listening to Burt Wilson do the Chicago Cubs baseball games and listening to WLS, the Prairie Farmers Station, and thinking, I can't do the farm work anymore because the bone disease won't allow that. So I started thinking, and I'm as bashful a barefoot country boy as you'll ever find, I wonder if I could do that, what they're doing. So he and I talked about it, and in my junior year, I was back on my feet and got into school. My English teacher, Mrs. Woods, got me into forensics. He got me into FFA public speaking. By my senior year, John, I was good. I was one of the five state finalists in the Wisconsin FFA public speaking contest. I knew I'd go to that state convention, bring the championship back to the 96 student high school in Ontario. I came in fourth out of five. Yeah. Got my tail whipped. Really got my tail whipped. But that's why I feel today that you probably learn as much from losing as you do from winning, because from that I learned.
You were salutatorian of your class, weren't you?
Yeah, but there were only 26. So, I mean, it wasn't that big a deal.
Didn't have to volunteer that all.
Didn't have to volunteer. But anyway, as salutatorian, I did get a year's scholarship to the University of Wisconsin. And as I look back on the decision my parents had to make, it had to be a tough one. My dad had a sixth grade education. My mother, 2 years of teacher's college. And now their firstborn has a scholarship for 1 year to go to the University of Wisconsin. I knew I wanted to be a radio announcer. So I went to the University of Wisconsin. At the end of 3 weeks, I was so homesick. And I was not getting to be a radio announcer. They were giving me all these books on journalism and writing. And I said, I want to be a talker. I don't want to be a writer.
Did you have the voice then? When do you think you became?
Well, by then I did. But, you know, when I was on my back with a leg disease, my voice hadn't changed. And that's really when I decided I wanted to be a radio announcer.
So you were going to be a broadcaster regardless of what happened to the pipes.
What happened to the pipes.
But then one day, I mean, you must have had the squeaky voice, and then
I
all
did.
Of us came
then
to
God
what
was
would
good
become our voice.
Yep.
But you must have realized, oh, wow, I got something going on here.
I do, yeah. So anyway, now we didn't have a telephone on the farm, and so after 3 weeks, I'm homesick and miserable, and I'm not learning how to be a radio announcer. So I called friends in town, and I said, can you get the folks to come in? I need to talk to them on the phone. Long story short, they were both reluctant to let me drop out. But finally, Dad said, find a place that'll teach you how to be a radio announcer, and you can drop out.
Did your family want you to stay on the farm? Did your dad want you to?
Well, he did, but he knew with my leg problem, I wasn't going to be able to do the heavy work of farming anymore. And, you know, life teaches you many things. But I look back on that incident in my life, which to me was a tragedy. My God, I wanted to, you know, be a basketball player, and I couldn't walk for 2 years. But it taught me to never evaluate a happening when it happens. Give it some time, because that turned out to be a turning point in my life.
Hope-dee-doo, hope-dee-doo. I hear a poke and my troubles are two.
So I found the American Institute of the Air in Minneapolis, which is still there today as the Brown Institute. And in 6 months, learned how to pronounce the name of every classical composer in history,
right?
Which I've never done since.
Right.
And became a radio announcer, and I finished on August 15th of 1952. And August 17th, went to work at WKLJ in Sparta, Wisconsin, and became a polka disc jockey.
So how old were you as a disc jockey playing the polka records?
I was 19. Yeah, playing Whoopi John, Lawrence Dugo, the Red Raven Orchestra, Cousin Fuzzy and the Cousins, Romy Gaz and the Goslings, Frankie Yankovic and the Yanks, and golly, all those big polka names.
People listen to that, huh? That was the whole thing.
Oh, Wisconsin's polka country.
Yeah,
it's polka country.
So then what happened? Did you graduate to larger markets, medium markets? You
went to Appleton, Wisconsin, and there became a nighttime disc jockey and took telephone requests from high school kids. And that went pretty well, but one night I got a phone call request for Mary from Tom entitled "I Didn't Know the Gun Was Loaded." And the next day, her father showed up saying, "My daughter is pregnant by Tom, so what are you doing playing that kind of a song for them?" And so that kind of put an end to my disc jockey. And so in 1956, the St. Norbertine Fathers owned WHBY in Appleton and WBAY in Green Bay. And they were doing an hour-long television show every day, Monday through Friday, agriculture, live band, the whole bit. We'd drive tractors into the studio and do commercials. And somebody up there remembered I'd grown up on a farm. They called me, and so I was there for 4 years. And then in 1960, Norm Kraft, who was the farm director of WGN, resigned on the air on a Friday afternoon and walked out to join Senator John Kennedy's campaign staff. And for some reason, Ward Quall, who was president of WGN at the time, he said, "We want you to come down here and be the farm broadcaster."
This is WGN Chicago, serving the Middle West.
So did your voice did your heart skip a little bit then? I mean, that's a long way from Wisconsin.
A long way from Wisconsin. And, you know, I just built a new house in Green Bay, built a two-story, four-bedroom house, cost me $24,000. And now I'm a big fish in a little pond in Green Bay. And then this opportunity to go to WGN, and I kind of looked at it as a gag. As a matter of fact, I remember when the call came saying, "We want you to come down and spend the day." I thought, okay, free trip to Chicago. That's fine. I'll go down there for a day. Because in Chicago, my golly, if you make a mistake, 10 people are there ready to take your place. And so I'll just go down and have a nice day. Well, I came down. I met Eddie Hubbard. I met Wally Phillips. I met Jack Brickhouse. All these, at that time, legends in broadcasting. And they were all nice. They said, "Gee, we hope you decide to come here." And Ward Quall, at the end of the day, said, "Orion, we want you." Took me 10 days to decide. And I look back on that, and it scares me to death. And yeah, I almost said no. It really does. But at the end of that 10 days, I decided, okay, I'll go to WGN, get their call letters on my resume, spend 5 years, and then go back to Wisconsin, buy a radio station, and spend the rest of my life back there. And I'll never forget, you know, when I finally agreed to do it, I'm in Ward's office. I said, "Do I need a contract?" I said, I don't know if you have to have a contract to work at WGN. Ward looked at me and he said, "Well, I was born in Ishpeming, Michigan. You were born in the Kickapoo Valley of Wisconsin. And I'll bet a handshake worked in both of those places." And I said, "Sure did for me."
So you shook hands?
We shook hands.
Was your first show, you were the host of Milking Time?
Milking Time, 5 to 5:30 in the morning.
Can we just pause and live with that for a minute?
Yes, we certainly can. Yes, we can.
There was a show called Milking Time on the radio.
On WGN.
I know, that's
50,000 watt clear channel.
I know.
Yes.
I mean, really, oh, times have changed. And, well, I don't mean to be flip about that.
Oh, no,
but I mean,
I
think about how in 50 years times have changed.
And at noon, we did a full hour with a live orchestra and a vocalist called Country Fair.
Yeah.
Later, it became the noon show. And we had a live band in studio. We had Eddie Mum and the Country Fair Boys and Elaine Rogers. Elaine Rogers was famous because she did the jingle, "Where there's life, there's Bud.
Where there's life, there's Bud."
She made thousands of dollars because Budweiser used that jingle, "Where there's life, there's Bud." And so she and the band traveled with me. We do about 40 remotes a year at county fairs and state fairs and farm progress shows and farm power shows and all of the other events. And then over the years worked with Captain Stubby and the Buccaneers and Lino Frigo and the Musical Wheels and Lola Dee and Carol March and just a lot of people that we worked with over the years. But one of the things I truly enjoyed, April 30th of 1960, WLS, the Prairie Farmer Station, overnight fired everybody. The next day became Wonderful Rock and Roll, WLS. Well, the WLS Barn Dance was an institution on that station, 8th Street Theater, which is now the International Ballroom of the Conrad Hilton Hotel. And so after I got to GN September 26th of 1960, I said to Ward Quall, I said, you know, great talents have been fired. They're out of work. We ought to bring the barn dance over to WGN. And he agreed. And so from 1961 until 69, every Saturday night, I was at WGN. I was the announcer.
Merry Christmas from Chicago, where the WGN barn dance is on the air.
We would start rehearsal at 3. We'd have 200 people in Studio 3 at WGN Television. And we would do a live television show 6:30 to 7. Then we'd chase that audience out, bring in a new audience, and at 8 o'clock we did a 90-minute radio version of the WGN Barn Dance.
This is Orion Samuelson welcoming you to another 90 minutes of great Saturday evening family entertainment.
I worked with Arky the Arkansas Woodchopper, Lula Bell and Scotty, Dolph Hewitt, Bob and Bobby Thomas, the Johnson Sisters, Bob Atcher, Arky the Arkansas Woodchopper. And we brought in big names, worked with Johnny Cash.
I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota.
I remember when Johnny came in to do a guest appearance, we had to lead him on stage and lead him off because he didn't quite know where he was. But when he was on microphone,
wow,
perfect. Just
well,
perfect.
You know, I was thinking about Ron Santo, and I thought Ronnie is one of those baseball players who, over the
right.
course of his career, played the game at its highest level,
right.
but wasn't playing it at a time when the industry rewarded that play as much as it does today.
True.
In a way, you're sort of the flip of that. I don't mean monetarily, but you were in the game when radio was really at its zenith. I mean, broadcasting today on the radio is still fun, and the technology we have is remarkable.
Oh, remarkable.
We can do things today that 15 years ago would have made our job so much more difficult. It's fun to be on the radio now. But that was the big time. I mean, orchestras and staffs. And did you appreciate that, or have you thought since then, wow, over the course of my career, I was at the right place at the right time?
Absolutely. Oh, without a doubt.
What fun?
Great fun, and, you know, known throughout the country because of what we did. As a matter of fact, September 26th, is the first time I ever said, this is WGN Radio, Clear Channel Radio, serving the nation from Chicago. And here I am 50 years later saying, this is News 720, WGN
yeah.
Radio. You know, and we're still there, and we're still doing what we do.
Yeah.
I've been everywhere.
A day I'll never forget. I can remember it was a November Friday, and it was rainy and very warm for that time of the year. And I'm doing a full hour at noon. Now, in those days, you couldn't play music on WGN radio if you didn't have a union musician in the studio to play the records.
Right.
Because Jimmy Petrillo, the president of the Musicians Union, said, if you're going to put my musicians out of business with records, we got to find work for them. And so WGN, we had record turners, as they were called. Couldn't play music if they weren't in the studio.
19 minutes before 1 o'clock. This is Country Fair from WGN Radio in Chicago.
So I'm doing the hour-long Country Fair show at noon. It's about 12:33. I'm doing the state-by-state forecast for the Midwest. Gene Doretti from the newsroom comes walking in. Now, there were no computers. All of our news came in on yellow teletype paper, United Press International, Associated Press. And he comes in and he lays this strip of yellow paper down. And as I'm reading the forecast on the air, I glance over and it says,
here is a bulletin from WGN News just handed me. President Kennedy has been shot and seriously wounded. Kennedy was shot at just as his motorcade left downtown
Dallas. Well, we played jokes on each other when we were on the air. We'd set fire to copy and all that sort of thing. And I thought, this is a strange joke to play when, you know, you're on the air. And I looked up into the control room, and I saw his face, and I knew it wasn't a joke. So I stopped the forecast. I read the bulletin. Now what do? You don't have internet. You don't have telephones. You don't have anything. So I've got this bulletin. I don't have a record turner. He's out to lunch. News director is out to lunch. Program manager is out to lunch. So I went back to the Indiana weather forecast.
Wow.
And then I repeated the bulletin. And then I went back to the Iowa forecast. And I repeated the bulletin. And finally, about 11 minutes later, record turner came in, and we went to music. And it wasn't until 1 o'clock that Walter Cronkite went on the air. And
from Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
But the interesting prelude to that goes back to May of 1960. I'm still in Green Bay. The presidential campaign is on. And John Kennedy comes to Wisconsin to do a series of speeches. Comes to Green Bay, does a couple of campaign speeches, and then holds a news conference at the Northland Hotel. And at the news conference, I asked probably three questions about dairy policy and agriculture and that sort of thing. The news conference ended, and this gentleman in a suit, one of the senator's aides, comes up and he said, "Have you got a minute or two?" I said, "Well, yes." He said, "The senator would like to talk to you." So we get out to the bar of the Northland Hotel, and I'm sitting in a booth with Senator John Kennedy, and he wants to talk about dairy and agriculture in the Midwest. 3 years later, I read the bulletin. He's been shot.
Good evening, Americans. I'm told I have 90 seconds. ABC complains that Paul Harvey's pregnant pauses sometimes last longer than that. But here goes. Farmland and ranchland, USA, no longer have the numbers on which our media thrive. So that vital, crucial, absolutely indispensable segment of our nation's population needs a big voice. Orion Samuelson's is a big voice. Orion Samuelson grew up with his feet in a furrow. Orion could have been our nation's Secretary of Agriculture under any of three presidents, but he was too smart for that. Instead, for eight presidents, over more than four decades, the Big O of WGN Chicago on hundreds of stations every day feeds the men and women who feed us the information they'd not get any other way. As attested by the highest award of the American Farm Bureau and the highest honor of his home state and the myriad recognitions in between, our industry broadcasting has achieved its highest purpose in serving the public interest, convenience, and necessity in farmland through the diligent dedication of one giant of a man. In our radio audience, in the people listening, in the radio audience tonight, let's try to visualize one guy representing 2 million. He's made of bent nails and rusty horseshoes and barbed wire and held together by calluses. With his wife, he's hunkered over a tabletop radio in the kitchen. He's hurting from tractor back, but he's up way past bedtime because he's heard that his best friend is being honored tonight. Well, by golly, he's right. And I want you to note that even the moon above is hiding its face at this moment, rather than to distract from the significance of this introduction, Orion Samuels.
Let's close with just talk a little bit about your travels. Then I just want to ask you about some of the people in this room and the sort of relationship you've had with your listeners over the years. But this kid from Wisconsin has traveled to 43 countries.
Right.
43 countries.
Yeah.
You were in China before we had normalized relations with China.
1978, April. Governor Thompson appointed a trade mission to go to China. The reason that he did that, we knew someday we would normalize relations, and here's a country then that had 800 million people. What a market this would be for agriculture and food, and he said they ought to know that Illinois can do it. So to make an impression, and there were 14 of us in that trip, we took a purebred Yorkshire boar That's a male pig, for those of you who have not. A breeding pig. We took a purebred Yorkshire Boar to China on the airplane through Tokyo International Airport into Shanghai when Shanghai had a parking lot that held 200 people at the airport, or 200 cars at the airport. And we took the pig that, in honor of the governor, we named Big Jim, and took that Yorkshire Boar to China, where they had 240 million hogs. Now, in this country, we have about 65 million hogs. They had 240 million at best count, not for meat, for fertilizer. I mean, if you were a hog in China and you dropped something and it wasn't on a field, somebody scooped it up and got it on a field for fertilizer. Yeah. So that was an interesting experience. We had three guides, all staunch communists. We got into some very strong discussions on capitalism, communism. And, of course, today it's a major market for the United States. Soybeans, corn, you name it.
Facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire.
Russia, well, Soviet Union, which no longer exists. One of the great trips I had, the Secretary of Agriculture, John Block, asked me to accompany him in 1983 when he went to sign the U.S.-USSR grain agreement. And he made my cameraman and me an official part of the party delegation. There were eight of us. We got into the Kremlin with our cameras, and I'll never forget the signing when they signed a five-year grain agreement. We're in this big room, the Minister of Agriculture of China, or of Russia, the Minister of Foreign Trade, Secretary Block, and filled with Russian officials. And they signed the agreement, and then we went into the reception room. Here is a long table, longer than this room. Bottle of vodka, bowl of caviar. Bottle of vodka, bowl of caviar. Bottle of vodka, bowl of caviar. And I admit, it's the one time in my career that I was intimidated by what I was saying. I do a weekly television show with my commentary called Samuelson Says. And my cameraman and I set up on a bridge with the Kremlin in the background. And I'm going to do an editorial, America, thank God for what you've got, because we live a free life compared to what's here. Well, as we set up the cameras, a crowd gathered.
Yeah, you don't want that.
And I'm looking at this crowd, and I'm thinking, okay, how many KGBs are in this crowd? And the more I looked, the more I thought, if I say something they don't like, I'll lose all the video I've shot on this trip and go home empty-handed. So I caved, and I waited till I got back in the studio in the U.S. to say what I was going to say there. One of my favorite countries is United Kingdom. Lottie Kearns was along when we did the noon show at 6 p.m. because we did the noon show from the Royal Agriculture Show in Stoneleigh, England. And it was 6 o'clock in England to do a 12 noon show back here. And the Royal Ag Show always attracted some of the royal family. And at that particular one, I spent 30 minutes at a reception talking to Princess Margaret. And she made a comment I will never forget, because we were visiting and her husband was into horses and equestrian activity. So at one point I said, well, Your Highness, I said, does your husband go with you when you go on your royal tours, or does he stay home on the farm? And her response, and I quote verbatim, she said, he stays home on the farm and takes care of the horses while I do my royal stuff. Royal stuff.
Royal stuff.
Yeah, royal stuff.
And you've worked with some interesting people over the years, too. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about your WGN experience. Who have you enjoyed working with the most, or you know, who have been some of the people that you'll always remember working at a GM?
Well, first of all, let me say this. I'm going to write the book. The title will be The Manure Tour, Life with a Farm Broadcaster. And I can honestly say that in the 50 years I've worked at WGN, there are only two people I have not enjoyed working with. Neither of them are at the station today. I will not name them until I write the book.
But you, and you'll name them in the book?
I will name them in the
Who
book.
Who have you liked working with the most? Was it Bob? Was it...
I couldn't stand Bob for the first 6 months. I thought WGN is ruined because he was so unlike Roy Leonard, so unlike Wally Phillips, so unlike everybody. He came in with this raucous laugh.
Hi there! Oops. But some of you listening right now are naked, N-A-K-E-D, naked. That means you don't have no clothes on.
I thought, oh, what are we doing at WGN with this?
And another naked story from Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Really, for 6 months, I hardly talked to Bob. And then we got involved in a cow milking contest at Wrigley Field. And when he took a look at that cow, and we have some dairy farmers here tonight, Joel and Linnea, he took a look at that 1,600-pound Holstein cow. And he said, you expect me to sit down and do something with that? and we became friends. And when we lost him in the airplane crash, he was my closest friend at WGN.
Now, I have something for you.
Oh, well,
but I have to go out and get this animal.
It's a shillelagh.
It is indeed a walking stick.
Read that.
It says... No, careful.
Go ahead,
Bob.
You can believe it or not, this is... made from the reproductive organ of the bull.
Very agricultural, Bob.
He had the amazing ability to go from something absolutely ridiculous and clownish to gun control, abortion, or whatever. Do it instantly and never lose credibility.
Yeah,
I've
right.
never seen that talent in anybody. And, of course, we both said, you know, we both had homes in Arizona, and we both said, well, when we retire, we'll sit on the front stoop and watch the desert go by. He's doing that. I'm not ready yet, but someday he and I will do that from up there.
Hello?
Never, ever heard such filth and smut.
Well, I'm sorry, madam. I didn't think...
You're a sick man.
Thank you.
Wally Phillips, fastest mind of anybody I've ever known. I watched him every day do telephone calls and respond with some of the wittiest remarks instantly to callers.
My recollection of Wally, when I was an intern, where you guys were still out of Bradley Place, after his show, he would go to the cafeteria. He would sit there and have his cup of coffee. Collins would come in. Collins would start dancing with the staff,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
The people that were cooking, the people that were there, it was a big room, and Bob was in the room. Sometimes when Bob was in the room, Wally was in the room. Wally was at a table by himself.
By himself.
And everybody just kind of understood that Wally wanted to be a little bit alone. How did you react to that? What was your recollection of that? Is that a correct recollection
of
my part?
Oh, yeah. It's very correct. And my feeling about that, Wally had just done 4 hours of intense radio. And if he wants to sit by himself, you know, to come down and to unwind. We all unwind after we do broadcasts and shows. And I had no problem with that. Some people did. But you had to understand Wally, that was the way he was. And it's funny, because for years, Wally tried to get me off WGN. He couldn't understand why a station in downtown Chicago would talk about cattle and hogs and wheat and corn and soybeans. And so I kept working on him that agriculture is pretty important and that our signal just covers the best farmland in the world. So years later, when he was retiring and winding down, you know, I kind of joshed him saying, well, Wally, for years you tried to get me off the air, and he vehemently denied it. He said, oh, I never did that. I said, yes, you did, Wally. You wanted to get me off the air. Well, when he discovered he had Alzheimer's, and he battled it pretty effectively, but I have in my possession, we have in a file, Gloria, a letter on a typewriter from Wally Phillips that he did before Alzheimer's took his mind. And he wrote to me just to say what an honor and a pleasure it had been to be on the air with me. And that I never tried to get you off the air, Orion.
I get that letter.
Yeah, he had to get that in. But he said, someday, when I'm up there, I want you sitting alongside me.
You know what fagioli means?
Come sta fagioli?
Fagioli doesn't mean anything. It means bean.
That's what I said. How you been?
Oh.
Everything you grow grows better with Rainbow, Rainbow Premium Plant Food.
Well, you have not only been a... seminal broadcaster, but you also then became, obviously, an ally for agriculture.
Yes.
I mean, you were the voice in the United States for the farmer. And every now and then we'd be reminded of that on the radio when the H1N1 thing came up.
Every day I said, it's not swine flu, it's H1N1.
Yeah, and nobody wanted to say H1N1. And every single time somebody said swine flu, you'd look around because if Orion was in the room, or Max for that matter, you'd have special hell to pay because that you felt adversely affected the farm industry and you were not going to allow that. On your station, that was not going to happen.
No. It did, but we worked very hard not to happen.
The other day, somebody said junk food, and you came running down the hall. This is just 2 days ago, 3 days ago. I forget what we were talking about, but we were talking about it, and you said, it's not junk food, John. All food is food. There's people in other parts of the world that would love to have that food. And I went, and you were scaring the hell out of Bertrand at the time, because he just thought he made a passing comment about junk food when you came down to wring his neck. You certainly remember that.
Oh, I do remember that. There is no such thing as junk food. If you're a starving kid in Nigeria, a Whopper is nutrition.
Yeah.
And so you call it fast food or whatever, but don't call it junk food. That's one of my campaigns. The other one is in invocations. I try to get people table prayers. They always say, bless the hands that prepared it. But I'm trying to get them always to say, bless the hands that produced it, as well as the hands that prepared it. And so, those are some of the campaigns. But yeah, junk food really irritates me. And making wrong references to food safety and to the safety of our food is a concern. And so since, as I said earlier, 2% of the people produce all the food that we eat and millions of other people around the world. And they have a very small voice. And so on this 50,000-watt radio station and on the television show Max and I do together, whatever we can do to help people understand what it takes to put food on the table, we're going to do it. I'm a journalist, but I'm a biased journalist when it comes to the people who put a roof over our head, clothes on our back, food on our table, and now energy in the gas tank.
So when you look out, I mean, this is a small sampling of your friends and the listeners. I mean, what's been the best part of talking on the radio all of these years? Do you think about people on the other end of the radio? Do you envision them sometimes?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because when I look at a microphone, I put a face on it.
Yeah.
You know, could be my mother, could be my friend, daughter, grandson. Yeah, I do. The best part of my job, John, has been people. People I've worked with and the people in my audience, whether it be the President of the United States or a corn soybean farmer in Illinois or a cattle rancher in Montana.
Did you ever put your dad's face on the microphone when you're talking into it on WGN? Is that one of the faces you imagine? Your dad lived to be 95, right?
95. So, ate all the wrong foods all of his life that they say will
junk
kill
food
you.
Sometimes,
and it did kill him at 95.
But I mean, So he got to see your career. He got to see a lot of the...
Never understood it. I did not dare tell Dad what I paid for the first house in Chicago, which was $240,000. My dad spent his entire farming career on the same farm. He was 67 when they sold the farm. And spent his entire life on that farm, he and my mother, and had the auction, sold the cows, sold the machinery, sold the farm, and realized $28,000 in all that time on the farm. And he had a couple of interesting comments. When the neighbor in Westby, Wisconsin, went to him when President Reagan was giving me consideration to be secretary, she told him, she said, do you know your son is being talked about to be Secretary of Agriculture? Dad's response was, oh, God, I hope he doesn't go to Washington. Then he'll be a crook like everybody else out there.
Touché, Dad.
That was his response to that. But I got the best job description I'll ever get from my father. He did not talk much. You paid attention when he did. Had no sense of humor, really. Was not a funny person. But after I arrived in Chicago, about a year later, I convinced he and my mother to come down and spend a weekend. One of only five times from 60 to 95 they came down. He was totally uncomfortable in the city. He'd walk in the door and he'd say, okay, we've been here, let's go home. And but first time they came down in 61, I took
took him down to the station, had him sit in the studio for the full hour, used all the big words I'd ever learned, trying to impress him with the fact he turned out something halfway decent. And we got done. He didn't say anything. It didn't surprise me. We walked down the hall to the office. He didn't say anything. We walked into the office, and I said, "Dad, what do you think?" His verbatim quote, "You know, it must be nice to be able to look at all that hard work and then just talk about it."
Thanks, Dad. You know, that's why we have dads.
That's what I do. That's what I do. Best job description I'll ever get. That's past your bedtime, and it's past mine. But at 2:45, the clock radio will go on to WGN. Gloria will get up and make coffee and send me off to the 52-mile trip downtown to be on the air at 10 to 5 tomorrow morning. And I thank her, thank my family, thank my pastor and his wife, and to all of my friends, and to my advertisers, and to my colleagues at WGN. Lyle, thank you. Just been honored with all the people I've worked with. Thank you.
50 years and continuing. The legend continues.
Orion Samuelson, a look back in celebration. Sponsored by Dairyland Seed, Illinois Farmers, and Gibson Steakhouse Rosemont.